You are listening to Faith is Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Room. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, the latest technology from Zendikar Rising. Then on the flashback, our testing results with Omnath, Locus of Creation. Finally, on the brew session, new decks with Cleansing Wildfire in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faith is Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am your host, David Robertson, joined by my guy on the West Coast, Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Hey. I mean, I'd much rather be debating fun magic ideas with you guys than listening to our president and former vice president debate on the air. I'll say that much.
Yeah, it's
Can I just interrupt for a second here?
Dan, you only have 2 minutes to talk, and it's not right now, so please let David Robertson finish his section.
Right.
So that was, of course, the voice of our CEO, the lodestar of the Faith is Brewing podcast. This is Cave Dan. What is going on, Mr. Dan Trever?
You're treating me very unfairly, David. Terribly unfairly. I'm hanging in there. It is Tuesday night. I've just finished watching the first presidential debates. Gosh, I mean, it's getting that time of the calendar year. We talked last week about now is the time to look into make sure you're registered to vote and that you know sort of logistically how to do it. Just going to repeat that now at the top of the show. The best time to do it was last week. The second best time is now.
Yeah, I heard David's call out of being an election worker, and I was like, oh, that sounds like a thing I should do too. I mean, I think I have the ability to take a day off work. And I went and I looked up, and it was Washington State policy. There's just no election places. It's just all mail-in this year. So I got out of performing that civic duty.
Yeah, and I guess just to reiterate, I think the reason why we're sort of harping on this more than we normally would is that I just think logistically, this election day, this season as a whole, but specifically the election day itself is going to be unlike what we've seen in the past, primarily because of COVID, but also just the meta-narrative surrounding it. I think there's a great deal of uncertainty surrounding the whole thing. And for better or for worse, you know, the American people have a track record of not necessarily participating in huge numbers in these things. And maybe, you know, we check in when it's time to vote. You know, we plan to just like, oh, we'll get around to it. We'll vote on election day. I think this year in particular, I think you should get around to it now and just make sure you have everything sorted out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you guys referenced kind of what a train wreck the debate was, and that's sort of emblematic, I think, of how the government is going to function on election night. So I think we should believe the current administration when it says it's looking to challenge ballots, when it's looking to send people into the polling places to check the vote, and et cetera, et cetera. So one of the ways you can really mitigate that type of stuff is to get out early, get your vote in, and minimize how much activity you actually need to be doing on election day itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of like an airline situation. I'm speaking to you, the listener, to put your oxygen mask on first, and your other mask as well. Wear a mask, please. Make sure that, you know, your vote is counted. But also, if you feel like you've already got that all taken care of, just check in on your people and see if anyone might need help, might need a friendly reminder. I'm not so much concerned about you, our witty, intelligent podcast listener, but I think each of us can sort of do what we can. You don't have to go so extreme as to sign up to go lobby for a candidate or something, but just do what you can to make sure that the people around you in your sort of personal network are all taken care of, see if anyone needs help, if anyone needs a reminder. We got to do our part.
Well said. So with the civic duty done at the top here, we want to segue into our housekeeping. So as always, we'd like to remind people, if you'd like to support the podcast, we do have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. The benefits are Discord access. You get the extended show notes, which is extra content. At higher tiers, you can get access to the super sweet Faithless Brewing playmats for delightful future role when we get to play cards in person again. You can get access to tokens. Yeah, so there's lots of cool stuff for people who are interested in joining the Patreon.
That's right. We're actually offering something new. A new benefit is that you can now get early access to the entire episode. We've been working with the Portland Pod, the terrific editing service, and they've been getting our episodes back to us so quickly after we record them that it's actually possible now for us to just upload this episode sometimes a full day or more before it's uploaded to the general public on Friday mornings. So if you're just eager for more Faithless Brewing in your life as fast as you possibly can, becoming a patron is a way to hear it before anyone else does.
One question. So, Dave, you comment, you know, get the playmats for when we get back to paper play, but have you guys tried any webcam magic?
No, I have not.
I haven't yet, but I've heard great things about it. Have you been playing that, Damon?
Yeah. So I when coronavirus started, I like tried something and I had this kind of like hacky setup. It was a pain to use. And then in the last month, I've really kind of like made my setup very easy to play, where I don't have to like, I just bought a separate webcam. They're $60 now. They used to be, you know, $300 for webcams when scarcity was high. And then I just kind of move my laptop over and I plug it into the webcam and have this sort of table I keep mostly cleared off. And so it takes me about 30 seconds to get set up. And it works out fine. There's this website, spelltable.com, which I haven't done a lot of research on, but I think Hasbro bought. That's a pretty good interface for there's a card search. It has life totals. I've been playing mostly in the context of Commander while waiting for Zendikar Rising to start and dabbling in CEDH, but it works pretty well. And it honestly, like, you know, it feels good to shuffle a Magic deck.
I miss that feeling. I'm excited to give that a try. Yeah, I saw that Spell Table had been acquired by Hasbro. So I hope that's a good thing. It seems to be a really useful, popular service, and hopefully they're getting more support now. But we'll see. Fingers crossed.
And we also have a new content site, faithlessbrewing.com. I think you kind of previewed the soft open last week, Dan. This is a new website that has a bunch of additional content. So it has articles. It's a place to find our podcasts. What else can people expect to find there, Dan?
Yeah, it's kind of a dual purpose site. It is both the official home of our podcast now on the web. So all of our episodes are up there, but also, you know, we generate a lot of just extra content that doesn't really make it into either the episode they're listening to right now or the description that you can find if you click on the episode description. So I've just been wanting to sort of put that into a more formal place, and writing articles is something that I've always had a great affinity for. And it turns out that a lot of the people, like-minded brewers in our community, feel the same way. So we've been getting some great contributions. I talked last week about a couple articles that I put up there. We've got a new one this week from Brian Madden. This kind of a deep dive on Arkham's Astrolabe replacements, bootleg or knockoff astrolabes, if you will, talking about things like Chromatic Star, Chromatic Sphere, and even Witching Well, a favorite of mine. Got a new one from Mana Symbol, looking ahead at the Time Spiral remastered set that's coming out next year. Damon, even you put up an article all about Canadian Highlander.
Even me. As winner of the Faithless Brewing Community League Season 2, I chose Canadian Highlander to be the Week 4 format. And since a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with Canadian Highlander, which is personally one of my favorite formats, I felt like I owed a brief exposition and list of resources to learn more about how to build a deck so you can face me or Dan or any of the other people in the Discord in the league this week.
What I found especially helpful about it is that I've understood that Canadian Highlander uses a 10-point system, and I've checked the list to see, you know, which vintage staples, which Power 9 cards are pointed at this or that thing. But it was hard for me to sort of translate that into actual decks. Like, why is Black Lotus in particular worth 7 points, apart from just being this iconic card? And I think you lay out really nicely, Damon, that, you know, these cards tend to lend themselves to specific packages. Like you said, Lotus is used often in kind of recursion packages and storm decks. So it's not just like they randomly gave it 7 points because it's a famous card, but, you know, these are like, the points clue you into sort of power packages that you can structure your strategy around. I don't think that I really computed that before.
Yeah, and once you play more, you'll start to realize things like, it used to be the case that Demonic Tutor was 3 and Black Lotus was 7, so you could play both in the same deck. But now they had it set up so you cannot play both DT and Black Lotus, which is just kind of a very clever way to use the points to balance the metagame and make it so that you can play the most powerful cards, but you're not going to see Black Lotuses and Mox in every game from every deck like you do in Vintage. And so I found it to actually be a really good mechanism that I really wonder what would happen if you use something like this. For example, in Commander, I don't think it makes sense to do it in Modern exactly, like, because of the, you know, it's not a Highlander structure, and so it's kind of weird. But for Highlander formats, it's a very nice way to balance things rather than the kind of the very rigid, is it legal or not, ban, no ban system.
Right, like Saheeli is pointed at 5, and Faladar Guardian is now worth 6 points. So sorry, you can't play those together in standard anymore.
Right, but if you have like a really fun Felidar Guardian synergy deck, like cool.
Yeah, so it's a great resource. And I think that's kind of just what I hope this website can be. Among other things, it's just a resource for brewers and people who just love Magic, love thinking about decks, love theorizing, love putting sketches together and seeing what new cards can do. We've also got, if you're not so much into just reading long articles and just want to absorb raw deck lists, we got some new ones from David going up this week. David's always sketching down crazy new ideas, and they don't always fit within our card of the week structure. David, do you want to just give a quick plug for some of these lists that you wrote about?
Yeah, so I had talked about the sort of Otter Neoform combo before. So it's basically like main decking Lutri the Spell Chaser. It copies Eldritch Evolution or Neoform, where you're getting a 4cc creature and then you're getting a bunch of Naru Mihas over and over again. And you're getting spark doubles, and then you just kind of one-shot your opponent by giving them all haste. Typically, Chasm Guide is the card. At various stages, when new cards get printed, I've tried them out, and Seagate Stormcaller and Salundi Vision are both cards I'm interested in trying. Seagate Stormcaller is another card that's like both a body that can be fodder for Eldritch Evolution, as well as a way to copy Neoform if Neoform is sacking a three-mana creature. So it can kind of start the combo on both ends. And then Salundi Vision, as you kind of highlighted, Dan, it's overcosted as, in terms of just a selection spell. But if you're selecting a spell that wins the game, I think you were talking about Dig Through Time or, you know, maybe one of the wheel effects if you have Narset in play or something. Well, this is another deck that specifically is looking for, you know, a Neoform or Eldritch Evolution effect. You don't want to have too many of them, because when you're flooded with those are not creatures, you can't win the game. So we're only playing three of each, but then we have the three Salundi Vision, and if we get flooded, we just turn that into, you know, a lot of looks at finding one of our combo pieces. Additionally, some of the copy effects, so two expansions, are also sort of faux tutorable by Salundi Vision. So you can find either half of the combo at times. So yeah, that's the sketch. I've kind of abandoned red. The deck is basically not looking to interact that much other than Brazen Borrower's front half. It's just kind of all in on the combo, trying to win maybe by like turn five. There's not a lot of counter magic being played right now. Everyone's just kind of in their own little bubble. Thoughtseize is one of the few pieces of interaction, so that's obviously good against you. But against decks like Omnath and Mono Green, Planeswalkers, etc., Niv-Mizzet, the deck actually kind of dodges a lot of it. Specifically, Seagate Stormcaller beats Teferi. You can play it and then sacrifice. Then you play your Neoform afterwards. So Teferi is no longer a one card like win against you. You don't even have to board in specific cards to beat it.
Oh, that's so interesting. I'm so used to these like things that involve the stack just evaporating once Teferi is in play.
Yeah, it's like a really weird thing where it comes into play first, its trigger goes on the stack and resolves, and then you cast your, you know, Neoform stacking your Brazen Borrower, and you proceed to win the game. Even all that stuff is happening on the stack, but you're not actually casting any spells, so Teferi's miserable blank text does not affect you.
That is definitely an advantage over my Blue-Red See the Truth deck featuring Goblin Dark Dwellers.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of interesting, actually, in Historic, people basically are making this deck because they get to play with Dual Caster Mage, but it basically steals the whole concept, most of the curve and all the spells, basically, that I've been experimenting with in Pioneer. But for various reasons, the Dual Caster Mage is legal in Historic, and it's not legal in either Modern or Pioneer. So it's kind of cool to see that deck get some traction. It's basically built off of the entire same base that I've constructed.
Yeah, so that's the Neoform Otterstop combo list featuring the Seagate Stormcaller. Another deck that you'd written about, David, was a black-green list that used Nissa of Shadowed Bawz in a really cool way. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this lands shell?
Yeah, so back when like Pioneer was still beautiful, Sam Black 5-0'd and I think posted a list first on Discord, and then obviously his 5-0 list got published. And it was sort of a black-green, but mainly green list that took advantage of sort of the interaction between Ramunap Excavator and Wayward Swordtooth, and then Fabled Passage and Evolving Wilds to like hit all these land drops from your graveyard, put all these lands into play. Once you found a Gitrog monster, you started to draw cards all the time, and sort of your ways to go over the top were Nissa Who Shakes the World. He was playing, I think, one or two Ulamog, the Ceaseless Hunger. And there's just a bunch of different cards that have been printed since then that are upgrades. So you can play Dryad of the Elysian Grove, so that helps fix your mana, because that deck was very light on black. And Dryad of the Elysian Grove can always block. A lot of times in the early game, Wayward Swordtooth cannot. Lotus Cobra is a card that I was talking about as being super powerful in Pioneer. It's been seen in a couple decks, but this is a card where it's going to really pay you off when you're generating these turns where you're playing 2-3 lands a turn, and those lands are Fabled Passage or Evolving Wilds from your graveyard over and over again. You're getting 2 land a pop from Lotus Cobra. So that combining with Tireless Tracker means you're just flying through your deck even more. I have one Scoot Swarm in here. This is a card that I think we're already seeing sort of generate these fail state cases in Arena. And this is another case. This deck's going to get to 6 land very quickly and then play 2, 3, 4, 5 lands a turn. Again, taking advantage of the fetch land. So that's a way to break board stalls. And then Nissa of the Shadowed Bow is going to get multiple land drops a turn. And that means it functions as basically a resurrection effect. So if any of these cards end up in the graveyard, you basically just get back the key card that you want. They kill your one Scoot Swarm, you get it back with your Nissa of the Shadow Bow. You need your Gitrog monster, same thing. And it survives, and it's going to keep adding, you know, tons of loyalty every turn. So basically, it just can -5 every turn.
Quick comment, y'all know it's Bow, right? Nissa of the Shadowed Bow? Nissa of the Shadowed Bow is like a arts and crafts sort of thing, I guess.
It's not a word that we say very often. I think I said it the other way during the preview episode, and then afterwards, I encountered several discussions online of like, which one actually is it? It's like Deck the Halls with Boughs of Holly. That's the pronunciation. But in my mind, it's still the other way. The new Nissa, we shall say.
So anyway, I've not tried this deck yet, but I really enjoyed the shell and the various permutations I played it in. And so the other card that's cool in here is Turn Timber Symbiosis. The deck has tons of free land plays because you're playing Dryad of the Leasing Grove and Wayward Swordtooth. So if you need an Atlanta, it can be that. But then in the late game, it's just a sort of 7 mana. You know, look at your top 7. Do you find a Gitrog monster or Ulamog? If you do, you're probably going
to
win.
I'm excited to see this list with Nissa of Shadowed Boughs. This card has not seen a ton of play. And is she great? You know, it's like going to take a list like this to find out.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that the card wants you to make landfall a bunch of times. But then it's not totally clear which of the loyalty abilities are your big payoff, because it's only the -5 is only as good as the creatures that you get back with it or cheat into play with it. So I think the way you laid this out, David, you're finding the reward within these supporting casts of like landfall creatures, not landfall creatures, but creatures that give you extra land plays. And that gives me some hope for this card that actually maybe it will be like a nice tool to sort of give a boost to a pretty unique strategy. So anyway, we'll say no more about this. You can find even more of David's thoughts on this on the website. And I'm just plugging these to sort of give you all a flavor of what kind of stuff you can expect to find on faithisbrewing.com. We're going to be adding more to it all the time. We're still, as David said, kind of in our soft launch, but it's firming up like dough slowly baking in the oven. So we got more content coming. We've got lining up some new contributors. So definitely bookmark that site. Check it out if you have not. And give us your feedback. We'd love to hear what you guys think.
All right, so with that checked, let's talk about the latest in the Magic world. Damon, there was a pretty big announcement that kind of came out of nowhere on Monday. Why don't you break that down for us?
Yes, that Wizards was going to release a secret lair featuring the Walking Dead characters. And this became the biggest news item of the day, in addition to the fact that they banned our own standard. But I think somehow the Walking Dead controversy got a lot more attention because at this point people are pretty checked out on standard. But let's start with the ban. So what do you guys think?
Well, I saw some funny memes about, you know, the one where there's like some commandos raiding a house and Omnath is like hiding in the kitchen cabinet watching them run by or something. So it's not totally clear. I think we talked about this before. No one could agree on what to change about this deck. Everyone understood that the 4-color Uro, Omnath, Lotus Cobra, Genesis, Ultimatum, Landfall deck was running roughshod over the beginning of this new standard format, so much so that we even talked about this deck succeeding possibly in Pioneer. The deck crushed the first weekend. They banned the old card, Uro. Actually, that was like the only deck that some people thought could challenge 4-color Omnath was the Sultai control deck featuring Uro. So that's gone now. What's left for this landfall shell? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, the 4-color Omnath deck that was terrorizing the SCG tournaments seemed to not really be this kind of fixed 75-card list. It seemed like there's a lot of variation in the list you would see. And it seemed like people were converging on less and less Uros. And so the Uros were being played more by Sultai Control as a deck that had game against the 4-color Omnath piles just due to the type of cards they play. And so somehow it's possible this Uro ban is kind of like the Bridge from Below ban where there's going to have to be a subsequent follow-up ban. I've seen a lot of people posit that it has to be either some combination of Lotus Cobra, Escape to the Wilds, and Omnath.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. They obviously don't want to ban cards from the set that just came out. Omnath is the card that's going to sell packs. Uro has already done his job, which was to sell packs of the set that he was in. So unless things get really bad, I don't expect them to ban a card for a while, and they'll just insist that everything is fine. And then if people stop playing and they stop making money from Arena, they will have to do their like risk-reward analysis versus what will cost them more money in the long run.
Yeah, well, rumor has it if they ban five more cards, you can escape Uro back into the card pool.
I've read some interesting analyses on like what went wrong with Standard right now, or with, you know, any specific card design like Uro or Omnath, whichever one you think is problematic. It just made me think, like, what a difference a year has made. You know, we started off talking about Niv-Mizzet Reborn right when War of the Spark came out, and I think there was a lot of skepticism. Granted, this was in the modern context, a high-powered format, but people seem to think that you could just can't cast a card like that. Five colors is too many. It's too slow to just, like, pay for a value creature. When Uro was previewed, granted, it is a mana cheaper and one fewer color, but I don't think I heard anyone say, oh, we can't cast this card. I think it's just a given now that, yeah, four mana, four different color pips. Sure, that's easy. So maybe the mindset has just changed, or people are just realizing that you should just follow the lead of set that is presented to you, where they're saying, here's a very strong threat full of all these abilities, and just try to cast it. And the tools are certainly there, at least in Standard, but especially in Pioneer and Modern, to get these multicolored threats in play.
Yeah, it turns out three drops that are good against both aggro, control, and midrange tend to be pretty good.
I mean, the argument that something went wrong, I think misunderstands like WotC's role. Like, Wizards of the Coast, it's a subsidiary of Hasbro, and every quarter Hasbro wants to know if they made money or lost money. So their sales have been up through all these bans, so they have done exactly what they're supposed to do.
Well, there is an argument that could be short-sighted. I mean, Standard is a format that is only played by people who want to play it. And obviously, if Standard dies, people will play other formats. The game as a whole won't die. But if people don't want to build Standard decks or play Arena because it's either a terrible format, or they just don't want to, you know, build a deck and have it be banned a month later, then maybe Standard as a whole just kind of dies.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely with you. I think they are super short-sighted, but because Hasbro is run by a bunch of business-degreed people, they aren't, like, gamers. This is what I mean by, like, eating next to your seed corn. Like, every quarter, they just see, like, the black line is going up a little more and the red line is going up a little less. It's like, wow, another great quarter for us. You know, like, fire up the Mistress, buy the second home. But then already you're starting to see, like, collapsing numbers for hours of Magic streamed on Arena is way down. Hours of Magic watched on Arena streamed is way down. So, I mean, eventually you just like reach the end. Nobody wants to be in a format that's solved on the first weekend. And it was basically solved by the time the preview streams were over. I mean, physical cards weren't even purchasable, and they'd already announced that they would be banning something. So, I mean, you know, just grinding all the joy out of something to make, you know, one little number go up is sort of what like Disney's doing. It's like, oh, did you love Dumbo when you were young? Good, because we're making a live action version where we're just squeezing every ounce, every cent we can out of any IP that you have any emotional attachment to until there's just, you can't even remember the thing that you loved about it.
I agree with your sentiment, David. I will say that I find one of your comments to be irresponsibly sexist. I think that an executive laughing their way to the bank can choose to have a second lover of any gender.
True. Good point. And there could be ladies taking, you know, lady executives taking.
Exactly.
Lovers of either gender as well.
And once you've dried up all the excitement for your IP, you do a crossover with another IP. Release a secret layer. We better not touch that topic right now. I think we should just...
Oh, I can't wait to be playing Legacy with dudes in leather jackets that look like they're out of a TV show that was... Yeah, nothing evokes a true feeling of a magical land that helps me escape from reality like, a dude with a leather jacket and a baseball bat.
I wonder if the actors, like, get a cut. Like, every time they sell one of those cards, you know, some actor has to, like, sign a check because he gets, like, 1 cent or whatever.
Oh, man. Enough about Hasbro. Shall we look at some deck lists?
Sure.
Yeah.
So tell me what's going on in Modern. We did a pretty extensive check-in on week one of, you know, Zendikar Rising Modern last week. How have things evolved since then?
I gotta say, Modern looks pretty wide open these days, just from playing in a league and then looking at these challenger results and watching other streamers playing. Tron seems to be on the downswing. There's just way too many Cleansing Wildfires around. The big new deck is this Oops All Spells list that I think was popularized by Canister, and Metsugen got a second place finish with it in the Saturday Challenge.
So is that the same as the Charbelcher deck that we talked about last week, or is this a different configuration of the Oops All Spells?
It is a different configuration. I don't understand what the pros and cons are. This is something that is just I think it's worth trying to figure out. This deck wins by milling the whole deck with an Undercity Informer or Balustrade Spy, which looks until you find a land card. Everything else goes into the graveyard, and all the lands are the modal dual-faced cards. And so they see as spells, so the whole deck gets milled. And then from there, you have to figure out a way to win the game with your whole deck in your graveyard. And there's many ways in Magic's history to do this, whether that be in Legacy, there's a deck that does something similar that does Dread Return into Lotlith Giant, which became Dread Return into Thassa's Oracle. This deck does it with some interesting combination of Salvage Titan, which reads you can sacrifice three artifacts rather than pay the spell's mana cost, and also exile three artifact cards from your graveyard to return to your hand. So you exile a couple of the talismans in the deck that got milled, bring it back to your hand, and then sacrifice Sword of the Meeks. The deck has exactly three Sword of the Meeks that will trigger onto the Narc Amoebas in the deck as they get milled. And so then you get to cast Salvage Titan, and since you already in this turn cast a Balustrade Spy, this will in turn trigger your second creature cast clause on the four Vengevines. And so you couple the four Vengevines along with four Creeping Shells, and that is just generally speaking lethal. And if it isn't, the deck has a few different ways to handle when that goes wrong. Although, actually, I'm not sure if Mitsugin's list has any... he has a single Nexus of Fate, so he doesn't actually deck out immediately. And likewise, Canister has these lines involving Memory's Journey to survive for a few turns if you need to get another Vengevine swing in.
Yeah, it's a really cool list. I mean, Dan and I are always trying to find a way to play with Salvage Titan, but I never had considered this as like the win condition where you're just triggering these Vengevines, you're still using the combat step, you're not as weak to Force of Negation. I mean, I think that's the big one. Force of Negation basically has no targets against this deck. Creeping Chill is not a Force of Negationable spell. You're casting a creature to trigger the cards to the graveyard, and you're casting Salvage Titan for no mana, and so none of those cards is affected by Force of Negation. So it's like a very clever way to get around one of the main deck ways people were interacting with this deck. And then I think it's going to other cards in the sideboard. They play the four Charbelcher there. So then you kind of, your opponent really has to get into a guessing game. What do I want to bring in? Do I want to bring in Graveyard Hate? Do I want to bring in Artifact Hate? Do I have to bring in everything and kind of abandon my A plan and hope I just like slow them down long enough?
I think structurally the biggest difference between this and the Charbelcher list is that Charbelcher is seven mana. You know, it's four to cast, three to activate. So you saw that list playing a bunch of ritual effects. Iron Crag Feat, Desperate Ritual, Pyretic Ritual. You know, even though you have a clean kill with the Charbelcher, you still need to find the time or speed yourself up enough to resolve that seven mana sequence. This is only four mana, right? As soon as you resolve the Balustrade Spy or the Undercity Informer plus sacrifice it, that's it. You don't have to do anything else. So you basically have more deck space available. I'm looking at Metsugan's list. There's four Leyline of Sanctity in the main deck. There's four Pentaprism, three Talisman. I mean, it is such a clever construction. Like, I would have never guessed that Salvage Titan had anything to do with Vengevine. If you're just like thinking on that galaxy brain level, it's like, okay, I'm casting a Balustrade Spy, I'm milling all my Vengevines. I just need to cast one more creature this turn to get the Vengevines back. How do I do it? How do I do it? Don't move till you see it. It's 12 moves away. It's there, as David would say. And it's like, yeah, all you need to do is get back your Sword of the Meeks, and then you can fetch the Salvage Titan out of the graveyard and cast it that way. There's even a Phantasmagorian here if these things get stuck in your hand somehow. So this deck has all the moves.
It's worth noting that the Phantasmagorian works regardless of where cards are at any time, because the Phantasmagorian can trigger in response to the trigger of your 1/1s. So they don't actually come into play. They trigger that they're about to come into play. In response to that, you can discard any of your swords to your graveyard. So it really is, I had no idea that this card existed, but this Phantasmagorian is like the key piece to allow you to win even if you end up with a bunch of these random cards in your hand, including Vengevine.
Oh yeah, Phantasmagorian is a critical card in the Legacy Dredge, no land dredge list, where they try to go to eight cards on their first turn and then discard that card and then use that card to discard three Golgari Grave Trolls.
Interesting.
Yeah, you learn to fear that card because it's you can't respond to it. It's just it's part of the cost to discard three cards.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a terrifying deck. It's got some cool counterplay in it. It's got this Charbelcher sideboard plan. I'm a little bit afraid of this deck. It didn't dominate the weekend, per se. I mean, it is still a graveyard deck and a combo deck, so you can maybe attack it with counterspells, with Graveyard Hate, with discard even. But it is, I think, proven itself. Or maybe it just took everyone by surprise, but Canister and Metsugin, these are are some of the top players out there. They both did very well in this challenge.
So yeah, the deck that won was a pretty like meat and potatoes, black, white, Orzhov, mid-range. The kind of deck that was really good like in 2014. Obviously, there's a few new toys in there, but it's interesting how sort of middle of the road this deck is. It's not doing anything fancy. It's not doing anything special. It's not taking advantage of any extra synergies. It's just playing Stoneforge Mystic, a bunch of Lingering Souls, and four Liliana the Veil that we don't see a lot of anymore.
Yeah, this is Musasabi's list.
If you have any questions, you might notice that Musasabi snuck in as the eighth seed to top eight, the only person at 15 points off of good tiebreakers. And so certainly a great result, but Lingering Souls may not be back in Modern to stay.
There's three Skyclave Apparition here. I mean, we talked about how there were so many medium white decks playing this card and succeeding really well last week, and here's yet another one.
Oh yeah, let's take a step back from this list in particular. Skyclave Apparition is everywhere in the queues right now. This card is the real deal. All the things that ever go wrong with Deputy of Detention type cards, this card is just not vulnerable to. Your opponent gets back at most a 4/4 token, which is not really a threat in Modern, and you can wipe out anything non-token. Creatures, planeswalkers, artifacts, enchantments, every permanent type besides land.
One of the cool things about this card is, like, Magic, one of the problems with design in the last 2 years has been they've really abandoned the combat step. Combat really only exists to attack planeswalkers. So if you yourself are not playing a planeswalker, and a lot of these white decks are not, the creature that you give them does not matter. The other deck is not trying to attack you, you know, in a mid-range way over the course of several turns with a bunch of 2/2s, 3/3s, 4/4s, and 5/5s to kill you. So giving them a 2/2 in exchange for getting rid of their mill artifact or whatever planeswalker, you know, a Teferi, is totally fine. Basically, just giving them a wall almost. Most of the time, it's just staying back to block. So, yeah, I think especially these white decks, one of the problems is they don't have any planeswalkers to play. That's the card that's really been getting a lot of the power juice from design the last couple of years. So they're taking advantage of a card that sort of punishes other decks for that. You take away their Teferi, you take away their Uro. They're just not going to get there attacking you with a 3/3 over and over again. That's not how these decks are built to win.
Yeah, that certainly resonates with my experience. I had a few of my permanents were turned into illusions this week, and I killed the Skyclave Apparitions mostly just out of spite and frustration, but like I didn't want the illusion token. It was just useless to me. So I think that's encouraging to just see like such a versatile tool for these fair decks. The other deck that won the Sunday challenge was also, I think, a pretty fair deck. It was actually a red-black Scourge of the Skyclaves Death Shadow deck, very similar to the ones that we were testing out last week. So I would say that Interactive Magic is still alive and well in Modern, despite some of these new combo technologies showing their stuff.
Yeah, the format seems to be in a great place right now. Even if it gets frustrating getting all your stuff turned into apparitions or turned into ghost by, I don't know how that works. But Skyclave Apparition is a very strong card to see on the other side of the battlefield.
Anything happening in Pioneer that you guys want to give a shout out to?
The number of people in the queues is still kind of alarming. You know, we're hoping that it's going to rebound a little bit, but I jumped in there and there was only like 190 people. So similar to when people were saying it wasn't very popular because of the combo world, well, the format is not full of combos anymore. So I'm hoping people do go and try to experiment with it a bit. I think it does suffer from the fact that sort of the most recent broken standard decks can just be played there. Plus Fatal Push and Thoughtseize, I mean, is sort of what the format is. So it's not quite the haven from the sort of standard gameplay situations that people want, maybe. And Modern is something that's got a bunch of unique cards that aren't present in Pioneer.
Yeah, and the thing that I find with Pioneer is that there just aren't that many decks in the metagame. Modern has a long, long tail of tons of decks. And you look at these challenges in Pioneer and you look at the queues and you just face a lot of the same decks over and over again. Which is kind of like a standard field, but standard rotates at a, you know, somewhat frequent cadence.
I mean, it's certainly more than standard. I would say there's, you know, 25 or 30 Pioneer decks, 60 Modern decks, and 2 standard decks. So like 25 is pretty good for Pioneer. Like I played 2 leagues this week and I think I only faced the same deck or same macro archetype even once, just the 2 versions of like a controlling strategy. But apart from that, yeah, it was full of recent standard cards, but this strategy seemed unique to Pioneer. I was just like, I was happy with the play experience, I'll put it that way. I think people should give Pioneer another shot.
Yeah, I mean, I played a League of Pioneer as well this week and quite enjoyed it. So I think it's back to being a reasonable format. You can do certain things in it. You can't do everything in it. You know, Modern does have a lot more tools, but Pioneer has a lot less broken things happening at times. And you can kind of tweak your deck to attack in a few interesting ways. So yeah, I definitely think people should be giving Pioneer a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we'll leave it at that for our roundup on what's happening in the metagame. We will take a short break, and when we return, we will tell you all about our testing results with Omnath Locus of Creation.
All right, we are back. So our card last week was Omnath itself. I guess it's a genderless elemental. This is a card that obviously created a bunch of consternation in Standard, and we wanted to kind of put it through its paces in some of the non-rotating formats. So first up, we had Modern, and Damon could kind of not stay away from a little Niv-Mizzet shell, which we posited, I think, on the day this card was spoiled, that it would find a home in Niv-Mizzet. So Damon, tell us about the sort of Niv-Mizzet shell you put it in, and tell us how the league went.
Yeah, so we discussed last week that Omnath could go into a kind of four-color Uro pile list or into a Niv list, and they kind of, in a lot of ways, are similar decks. But obviously, you know, I love Niv. I've played a lot of that deck, although I haven't played a lot of it recently. And so I looked at some lists online, and Niv lists are always very, very kind of up to the pilot. There's so many, arguably the whole deck is a flex spot besides the Nivs themselves. And so the one I found that I liked or that intrigued me was one from God of Slaughter from the most recent Challenge Top 8 from last weekend. I think they got fifth place. And what was interesting is that it's a lot of, you know, stock Urian Niv with the Sprawls and the Bring to Lights and the Abundant Growths and some Helixes and things like that. But it also had a Stoneforge Mystic package, which I found to be very interesting. I used to love playing Stoneblade in Legacy. And I was like, well, maybe these cards belong in a Niv-Mizzet deck. You know, they're not gilded, but they're also objectively powerful. And you can play Icefang Quetzals, which are gilded. And then those snakes love to wear all sorts of swords and Batterskulls if the need arises. Meanwhile, I figured Omnath would give you a lot of mana to start re-equipping a Batterskull or mess around with swords. Yeah, so I took him to the queues, and I was immediately greeted with a lovely Niv-Mizzet hand, which was a Swamp, Stoneforge Mystic, Renin 6, Lightning Helix, and a few other cards, and so just nothing was castable, and I mulliganed, played against...
Oh, you're just one Astrolabe away from having perfect mana.
I know. I know. It's very sad. But yes, that one being a match against Red Black Shadow, and the equipment were just totally, totally terrible. I drew too many of them. The Stoneforge Mystics just died to any number of bolts or dismembers. But Shadow's always been a pretty decent Niv matchup, and since they gave up blue, that gave them one of their best answers to Niv in the form of Stubborn Denials on your key spells or any number of Disdainful Strokes on the Niv himself. But the red-black lists just don't have access to that, and so you survive until you play a Niv, and then the game basically ends in classic Niv fashion. So I won that 1-2-1. I played against a million Skyclave Apparition triggers in the form of Blue-Eyed Soul Herder. I won that match with 12 seconds left on the clock after losing game one in a very, very long game. I smoked blue-green Eldrazi in classic Niv fashion. They had some smashers and I had some Nivs. Played against Pro Tour champion Eli Loveman on white-green Heliod. It was a very interesting matchup. In game two, he assembled the infinite life combo, and I wasn't sure if I should concede or not because I have more cards in my deck and I have Unmoored Egos. I can try to start exiling his Walking Ballistas. Maybe I can get a Renin 6 to ult and then cast a bunch of Unmoored Egos. So we have a few turns go by where he gains a bunch of life, but then I realized that I didn't have Unmoored Egos there on the sideboard, and so I scoop. Sorry, Eli. And then in classic fashion, I beat Bogles in the last round, who got salty at me, and that's the 5-0. So Niv never disappoints, I guess.
The Bogles player got salty.
Yeah, they're like, how come you slow roll the Kaia's Guile? I was like, I didn't slow roll it. I just took me like 30 seconds to figure out how I was tapping my mana to cast it. It wasn't like I didn't cast it early enough.
So how was Omnath in the list?
Omnath was great. Let me put it this way. If the card didn't cantrip, it would sometimes have this weird gap where like you don't have anything to do and you don't have like a fetch land, you can maybe not even get the four mana. But it cantrips, right? So, like, who cares? We used to play Tulsimir, and I loved Tulsimir. I thought that was a very fun card, very fair card. Filled a really critical role in the deck, and Omnath just makes Tulsimir look like yesterday's garbage. One mana cheaper, gains one more life, doesn't fight a creature, okay. but randomly gains you 4 mana or kills your opponent's planeswalkers if you have enough fetches lying around. So the card is quite good. And you play Omnath on turn 4 or turn 3 with Utopia Sprawl, or you play a turn 4 with Utopia Sprawl, you make your land drop, the land drop's a fetch land, you fetch a black mana, and you have Niv mana. And so all of a sudden, you could just cast Niv and still have a bunch of lands untapped. And then you draw all the spells off Niv, and then you can just do whatever you want to do with those spells. And so the Niv turns just became so much more explosive. And meanwhile, Omnath is just a win con in his or hers or its own right. You can flicker Omnath with Urien, which is, you know, not the most exciting cantrip, but it is, in fact, you know, a cantrip. And so Omnath really was a good card in this list.
How often were you getting the extra mana, and what were you doing with that mana?
Oh, I got it pretty often. I mean, the deck plays so many fetch lands and Renin Sixes. And so the extra mana was typically used to cast a Bring to Light, just because it doesn't take a lot of thinking to figure out how to get the mana. Normally, Bring to Light, you like look at your Triumphs and Brawl lands and stuff, and you're like, how do I cast this card in the most efficient mana that lets me maximize the cards I can cast after I play this? Which is typically just a sort of unsolvable problem because you don't even know where you'll hit off Niv. But with Omnath, you just have the Wooburg mana and you use it. You can also use it to basically grab Urien and cast Urien in the same turn pretty easily. And we know how profitable that can be in a deck with Sprawls and an Omnath in play. So yeah, it was pretty rare that I just had nothing to do with that.
So it sounds like Omnath, big thumbs up for this list. Stoneforge package.
Big thumbs down. There's just no need to play cards like that. Opponents typically have interaction for it. The deck doesn't need to win with these. It doesn't need the grindiness of a Batterskull. It doesn't need to rely on sort of Feast and Famine to grind down a control matchup. As long as the cards were okay, you know, like I did get a couple sort of Feast and Famine triggers that let me double spell. And that was nice, but it just wasn't worth the times that it wasn't very good. It wasn't even close. I would not recommend playing Stoneforge Mystic in a Niv list. One thing I'll say, though, is that the Niv deck of old with Astrolabe was a very tricky deck to play in terms of knowing what to fetch and how to sequence the Sprawls and Astrolabes and what color to put the Sprawl on and how to sequence your spells to survive until Niv and then make a plan that will work well post-Niv. But the new deck with the Triumphs and the fetches and the Urien and the Omnath and the Uro and the Uro and the Uro and the blue-blue-green-green, it is a complicated deck to play that was a bit of a headache to the point where, like, I really enjoyed playing the old version of Niv, and this deck was like kind of a chore to finish a full league with, even though it seemed to be a very capable, good deck.
Yeah, I suspect that if I picked this up, I would find that Astrolabe has made my my mana math get all fuzzy and muddled. Because when you had Astrolabes, everything just worked out, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's like,
And some of this, I'm sure if I play this list for 3 more leagues in a row, I start to understand, oh, here's where I fetch Indatha Triome versus Rogrin Triome versus just a normal Shockland. But it takes a while. And the color requirements of Omnath, Niv, and Uro Escape just really mess with you.
So a list that I would like to test, I'm going to propose it just as something we should explore. I didn't have time to play it, but I was thinking that if Omnath is so strong in this Niv-Mizzet shell, what if we did what David said and we just went down to 60 cards to draw Omnath more often? Maybe play a full set of Omnath, like the full 4, and just try to get it out even faster. So Utopia Sprawl, we've been high on that forever. Is there another acceleration option? And it occurred to me that maybe Simeon Spirit Guide is worth another look. The way that some of these Niv lists are built, they're very heavy on Lightning Helix. I think that's going to continue to be good as long as red is in the format. They're very heavy on Renin 6. Omnath adds a bunch more red pips. It's actually a very red or even Naya heavy sequence in the early turns. So I think that you have a lot of places to put, you know, the burst of speed from a Simeon Spirit Guide, even if it's just something as simple as turn 1 Renin 6 and start getting lands back. But the dream would be that you could do like the Uro fetch land Niv-Mizzet sequence a turn early, and then it's like you got double use out of your Simeon Spirit Guide because it gave you an extra mana for the Omnath, and then the Omnath gave that mana back. So it's like the Simeon Spirit Guide carried over for the whole turn.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. If Omnath is, you know, the card that's like sort of stirring the drink, then that might be worth exploring. You also can play, I mean, it can naturally accelerate you into Niv-Mizzet as well, right? I mean, you could just play your acceleration on turn 1, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you're getting your Niv-Mizzet on 3, and that would be pretty sweet.
Yeah. I have to say, we used to play Birds of Paradise, and that card was always, you know, not bad. SSG, I don't trust that card. If you get your Omnath out of turn early and they kill it, then you are down and can't cast Niv the next turn. If you wait to cast Omnath with the open mana, you could have actually just done it the normal way and not really lost any time. And so I'm not really sure I believe in the SSG in this list. But that said, you know, it's worth trying lots of things, and sometimes it's good to have friends that think do things that you think are crazy so you can learn from it without having to waste your own precious ticks.
Well, just one note, if they kill your Omnath after you accelerated it out with Simeon Spirit Guide, you're not down, you're even, because Omnath gave you a card back. Omnath is very removal resistant, so you lose two cards, but you got one back, and they spent a kill spell, maybe it was a Path to Exile, and then you're up a land.
Yeah, Omnath is actually pretty durable, but, you know, it's a kind of a tempo game sometimes. Times, and that's the concern here.
Yeah, well, that's a theory to test. I will probably try that out later, and if anyone has tried this, I would love to hear about how it went for you guys. I'll post my proposed list in the show notes that are in the episode description. So sticking with Modern, David, you had an interesting list that we didn't really talk about last week, but when you described this shell, I thought it kind of clicked, like, oh yeah, I could see how Omnath would be a nice addition to this strategy. Do you want to tell us about the list you played?
Yeah, so this is pretty close to like the four-color Soul Rider list that I really love from the like first week when Companions were at full strength. It takes advantage of like four Ephemerate. That list, you know, got to play... the our band Snow Mana Enabler, so I also was having to play this the crappy Abundant Growth. You know, you have a bunch of two mana cards that draw a card, and then I was playing the full four Skyclave Apparition, so I wasn't playing Path Apparition, as I pointed out, you know, when it was spoiled, is an amazing card with Ephemerate, and this is a deck that's blinking tons of stuff. And then you basically have Omnath in there just as a sort of like value target to find. It allows you to really take advantage of Urion on the following turn, where you can kind of get Urion into your hand and play it all in the same turn very easily. And then it's just another card that, you know, pays you off for having an ephemerate trigger, pays you off for having a Restoration Angel. You do have a bunch of mana sinks. You have, you know, cards like Court of Calling and E-Witness, stuff like that, that can use a bunch of lands. So yeah, I thought it was a reasonable card. The deck was already playing exactly those four colors as well. You're splashing red in the Urion shell to play Kiki Jiki, and in my case, one Avalanche Rider main and three side. So the mana was fine. I just took my mana base from my old list and didn't update it at all. So there should be like two Triumphs in the mana, and there weren't. It didn't end up mattering ever, but it was still an oversight on my part. So definitely don't copy the mana base.
So I got to ask, why just one Omnath? It seems like, you know, a perfect value card. This is a deck that can use extra mana. It's got a lot of stuff to do. Can use the time that the life will buy.
The problem is, even though the deck is 80 cards, you actually don't have that many slots. You need to be able to accelerate. You need four Ephemerates. If you're going to play the Kiki Jiki package, you know, that's three cards plus the four cords. I was even cutting other cards that I wanted. And then I like having a bunch of random effects. So I like playing the one Soul Herder. I like having the one Uro. I like having one Venser. I like having the four Skyclave. So you just start to run out of slots. And Omnath is a fine value card, but the deck is made out of value. So what you actually need is more cards to interact. And Omnath is not that. So it's possible to configure a different kind of deck with more Omnath. But I think this kind of deck, it just kind of gives you more of what you already have. And it's a fine target. And it is actually a good card against aggro, because it just turns into this life-gaining machine. You don't even need the mana. If you play it, play a fetch land on your turn, gain four, you know, in their upkeep, sack your fetch land. And all of a sudden, you've, you know, almost doubled your life total.
Yeah, but maybe you just skip the interaction and add more Omnus, some Lotus Cobras, and some Genesis Ultimatums, and just go way over the top.
Straight from Standard to your Modern League.
I mean, it's a proven pattern, at least in Standard.
That seems a bit extreme. I wouldn't play Genesis Ultimatum in Modern, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to win in extremely value fashion?
Yeah, I'm talking about attacking for lethal with 12 seconds on the clock with two Kaya's Guile spirit tokens. That's what Modern's all about.
That was a close match. My heart was pounding with it at that point.
Another question, David, I want to ask you about Court of Calling. So one list that I've been noticing more and more is just a lot of Illidamri's Call decks. I think that maybe it was Nassif was playing a Soul Herder list where there was all four Illidamri's Calls, and maybe even just one Soul Herder like you have here. I've seen also just like green-white Titan decks, evolutions of that, you know, Elvish Reclaimer, Ether Vial type strategy. They're just picking up a bunch of copies of Ely Damry's Call. Made me wonder if that's just become the better tutor. And this is a deck where I think you could just choose one or the other. You went with Accord. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so Eladomri's Call specifically functions very well with Ethervile. F. Paul's green whitelist takes advantage of that and specifically needs to have the Dryad in play for most of its wins. And Nassif's list was a 60-card list that was also playing Ethervile. And I think Aspiring Spike also tried a bunch of different shells where he's playing two or three calls, and again with Ethervile. So I think the Ethervile is the key there, where you almost can like instant speed in your 2 and 3 drops with your call. This having a variety of targets and setting up like end game loops where you're getting like your EE into Resto, you know, blink your Witness and then find your Kiki Jiki, etc. I think it's still a little better. The mana was tough, but again, I think it's because I wasn't playing Triomes. There's plenty of ways to add a few more green sources to the deck. So I prefer in a shell like this, the Eladomri's Call like on EOT for your 4-mana card or whatever is just quite a bit slower if you don't have Ethervile, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one way I would think about this is that if you only have one creature, they're equal on mana. And if that one creature is a Birds of Paradise, then Eldimer's Call is actually cheaper on mana. And so you have to have like a number of creatures out to make Court of Culling more efficient. Ethervile is one answer. You'll see the Devoted Druid combo decks don't play Ethervile, but they also don't play Court of Culling. They play Eldimer's Call. And that's because they're playing a pretty low resource game. They may not be able to have enough creatures to get a more efficient Court of Culling after trading off stuff early. Whereas the Soul Herder deck, in comparison, just floods the board with creatures. Your Oracle draws you into a Wall of Blossoms, draws you into a Ice Vein Coatl. And so you get to this point where you have, you know, 8 creatures on the board or 5 creatures on the board in a high resource game. And that's where Cord, both the instant speed getting the creature into play can be quite good. And it becomes much cheaper on mana.
Also, the card Urion has a very strange effect with Cord where it, like, Urion sometimes is cast for free. If you have 6 lands in play and 5 creatures, you play your Urion. You blink all your creatures. If some of them tap for mana to play Urion, let's say you had 2 birds or something, Urion comes into play, removes all your creatures that attacked and everything else. They all come back into play untapped, and all of a sudden you can EOT. You know, you might have 5 or 6 or even 7 mana available specifically if you Cord. So, you know, Cording for Resto with Urion in play is about as good as it gets.
So one question I have for you, David, what were your common Cord targets? Did you get Omneth with Cord very often, or are you finding just more of the typical creatures?
I was having to get cheaper creatures because I was playing aggro decks. So like you are Blue-Red Prowess and Soul Sister. So I was always needing to find my Skyclave Apparitions. Unfortunately, I didn't get to do anything fun, really. I would have loved to have get Omnath, but I just didn't have enough time. You know, that's a 7 mana Cord, and that's not trivial.
I find those heuristics very helpful. I think thinking of the Eladomri's Call Ethervile as like a tight package makes a lot of sense. And even what you're saying, David, about the ceiling of Court of Calling being higher as you have these sort of high mana targets in the deck is something I hadn't really considered either. So I can see how that all works out, and I'm encouraged by this list. It looks like you get to play a lot of fun magic, put a lot of triggers on the stack, full set of Skyclave Apparitions, so you know you're doing interactive fair stuff.
Yeah, like an archetypal example that happened against Tron was they activated the artifact to clear all my creatures. I only had enough to court for 2, but I courted for 2 to get my Charming Prince to blink out my Resto Angel until end of turn. Then Resto Angel came into play at end of turn after everything had been swept away and they'd, you know, resolved their Worm Coil or whatever. And I just played my Kiki Jiki and won from there. Eladomri's Call in that case would have lost, would not have won the game. I don't know that I would have necessarily lost. Sneaky, sneaky. See, I think this list is maybe just a worse version of Niv. You're just playing cards that are a little lower power quality, and you're fixing. I mean, your mana is a little better, but the black splash is kind of free. And I think Niv-Mizzet is a little bit better positioned when there's so much prowess because it's basically just a pile of removal and then like 8 card advantage generating cards at the top. And I think that's just a better position place to be than trying to generate your advantage with your low mana creatures, then eventually turn them into more advantage.
One thing I do like about Omnath in this list is that these lists are very extremely ridiculously vulnerable to Torpor Orb. And Omnath gets slightly hosed by it, but not extremely hosed by it because the landfall triggers still work.
Yeah, I was thinking about playing cards on the side to like hedge against it. And I was like, I'd rather just lose a Torpor Orb. I don't think enough decks are I don't think it's good enough against other decks for people to even consider it. So I'll ride or die.
It is the most painful way to lose. You're like, oh, okay, let me, I can go find my Skyclave apparition in my day. We used to have to play Night of Autumn. Wait, that doesn't work. Oh, I'll just get Urien and flicker my stuff. That way, that doesn't work. Nothing does anything in the deck.
Well, it's funny, you know, against Tron, they resolve their 4-mana Karn. So if they have one in their entire 75, they have it that turn. So you're just like holding your breath and it's like, all right, they get whatever, anything but that. You're like, all right, I could win this one.
So that's Modern. We had a nice 5-0 with Niv and I think some promising leads on this Blink deck. You said you're 2-2 right now, David?
Yes, and all the games were sweet. So that's the more important thing.
So let's dip over to Pioneer. I took on Pioneer this week, where we talked about a few different possible homes for Omnath. We talked about sort of the standard port that's just like a Genesis Ultimatum ramp deck. Even we talked about a Teemer Reclamation style deck, and just like the good stuff Omnath decks. I wasn't really feeling those for testing purposes, so I ended up going in a really weird direction, inspired by a tweet from Will Urker, who's a brewer that is often working on some crazy stuff. He just tweeted out a list. I don't even know if he played it or not, but it was built around the card Unexpected Results and new ways to maximize that using cards from Zendikar Rising. So Unexpected Results, 2 blue-green, sorcery, shuffle your deck, reveal the top card. If it's a spell, you get to cast it for free. If it's a land, you get to put that land into play, and then the Unexpected Results goes back into your hand. So it's kind of like you spin the wheel in the most thrilling way possible. Obviously, to really maximize your results, you could put in some huge Eldrazi, Emrakul, Ulamog, that kind of thing. You will get the cast trigger because it is casting the card. I think, Damon, you actually lost to this deck in Modern once at a feature match at a Grand Prix.
That was 4-0 GP Minneapolis. I faced up against Unexpected Results, and they had immediately flipped an Ulamog.
Yeah. I mean, what were you expecting? Not that, but it says right there on the card. So Will Urker had proposed a list that had similar top end, so Ulamog the Ceaseless Hunger and Emrakul the Promise End. But what was really cool was that he had identified that the mythic fliplands from Zendikar, so Turn Timber Symbiosis and Seagate Restoration, they count as hits off the Unexpected Results that are kind of exciting payoff spells. So you treat them as lands when you're building your mana base. So it's kind of like a blue-green ramp core with a bunch of lands, but 8 of those lands are actually double as big hits off the Unexpected Results. So let's say you cast Unexpected Results and you happen to hit a Turn Timber Symbiosis. That looks at your next 7 cards, and you get to put the Ulamog into play for free that way. So it's almost like you have that many more great hits. Now, granted, the Turn Timber Symbiosis will not give you the cast trigger, but you will get a giant beater. So that was like the concept, and to sort of supplement it, you need to have a sort of plan B for what if you don't have Unexpected Results, or what if you draw all these high-end payoff cards. And Will Urker had proposed just a ramp core. So I think he was playing Grow Spirals, Hour of Promise, Migration Paths, Uros, that kind of thing. And with Hour of Promise, you're looking to get like 2 Shrine of the Forsaken Gods to unlock your Eldrazi. So it wasn't an Uro deck. It was actually straight blue-green, but it seemed to me like this is such a cool concept. I bet Omnath could do a similar thing. It will give you like a backdoor way to ramp really big in one turn. If you get to untap with Omnath and then you get to play like a Fabled Passage, you know, that could be your backdoor way to get to cast a Ugin or a Ulamog or something like that. So I started to sort of rejigger the deck to accommodate 2 more colors. And what I ended up with was a 4 color pile that had a similar core, but it actually was a little bit lighter on the Eldrazi because I could no longer justify playing Shrine of the Forsaken Gods in a deck that needed to cast Omnath. So the colorless lands got the axe, the Hour of Promises got the axe instead, and I ended up playing even more of these flip lands. I decided to add Emeria's Call, the white mythic flip land, a full playset of that as well. So I had 12 mythic flip lands. These are 7 drops if you hit them with Unexpected Results. So maybe I could just flip up 2 angels on turn 3 or something and maybe win that way. What do you guys think of this concept?
I was pretty intrigued when you sent Will Urker's list. I thought that was a really cool idea. unfortunately, I think all the major uses of these dual mode lands, at least the mythic rare ones, have been to basically like cheat on how we interact with the normal state of Magic. I do think to really get the most out of Omnath, you need multiple land drops, which you identified. So you're playing your four Fabled Passage. Omnath technically can get the mana back from Unexpected Results, which you pointed out. I didn't even think about that, right? If you play your first land, you get your four life. Unexpected Results gives you your four mana back, and then Unexpected Results goes back to your hand. You can cast it again. I thought that was really cool. Yeah, there's just a lot of moving parts here, so I was a little nervous. I mean, obviously, you can get lucky with Unexpected Results, and the deck looks amazing, and then you can sort of run like normal, and you can hit Augur of Bolas or something, and you're like, well, it was the best of times. It was the blurst of times.
Yeah, I'm generally skeptical of any list featuring Unexpected Results. I have a vendetta against the card after losing to it in horrific fashion. But it does really feel kind of like a meme card. And so the question is, do these MDFCs plus Omnath give it a way to work that we haven't seen before? And so in that sense, yeah, I mean, it's quite plausible. And certainly, I'm glad Dan tried it.
Better my tickets than yours. Well, in this case, the first league, those tickets were quickly vaporized. I went 1-4 and learned some harsh lessons about just basic deck building mistakes that I've made. The biggest one was that, like David, I still haven't quite internalized how to build around Triomes. I just like forgot that you should put a bunch of Triomes in your deck. So I only had two on my list, and I just like cut one to the last minute to get the extra Amarius Call in there. I should have played like 6 or even 7 Triomes. What I forgot was that Growth Spiral and Uro just give you a bunch of like extra land plays that you weren't going to use. So like there are a bunch of times when you have the opportunity to put a tap land in. On the other hand, what I thought was going to happen was that I thought that Sylvan Caryatid and Dryad of the Elysian Groves would, fix whatever I was missing. That didn't really work out. I mean, the Caryatids kept dying. They do die to your Ugins. And if you're in a desperate situation, you don't really have a choice. You have to sweep away the board, including your own Caryatids. And then suddenly you're left with just like Omnath you can't cast. I was paired against Mono Red one round, and I thought I did everything according to my game plan. I stabilized and I had Omnath ready to deploy. I actually had 2 Omnaths in hand, about to run away with the game, but I only had 2 colors of mana in play because I lost my Caryatids and my Dryad. So it was just an embarrassing way to lose. When you're doing a mana base like this, these mythic flip lands only provide a single color of mana, right? So you basically have a bunch of single color basics that you'll just draw in random sequences, and you really need something to smooth out the colors.
So I saw you were undaunted by this finish. You took the lessons that you learned and you made some updates to your mana base. And to your deck configuration.
I did, yeah. So the lessons learned were that A, the mana was wrong, the Triomes should have been there. B, the Dryads were just like not working out. I found that even with 30 virtual lands, 18 real lands and 12 of these double-faced lands, this deck was still so greedy for mana that I just needed to keep hitting every land drop. And at that point, the Dryad isn't actually giving you as much as you might think. Like you actually just need to draw more cards and have more raw quantity of resources. I would just like have Dryads and nothing to do with them. As the game dragged on, I'd be stuck at like 5-6 mana. I still just needed to keep hitting land drops. So those got cut and got replaced by Teferi Time Ravelers for the next league because I learned the hard way in the first league that blue-white control is a problem. They have Teferi, which actually shuts down Unexpected Results very frustratingly. they also have, I think a red deck got me with Grafdigger's Cage. Unlike Bring to Light, which exiles the card and gets around Grafdigger's Cage, Unexpected Results leaves the card in your library, so you just can't do it with Grafdigger's Cage in play. You can still cast it, and if you hit a land, then you got around Teferi or whatever, or Grafdigger's Cage. But if you don't hit a land, your spell resolves and does nothing. So I needed a little more countermeasures against control, so I brought in the Teferi to the main deck. The other big change was that Ugin was kind of disappointing in the first league. I found that I just like needed more card advantage against these blue-white and Bant ramp decks. So I actually wanted to try out the red Gearhulk from Kaladesh instead of Ugin as sort of my bridge payoff. So this is a card that what I hope will happen is that I'll cast it, I'll get a 6-6, and I'll draw 3 cards. Combustible Gearhulk says when it enters the battlefield, the opponent chooses either you draw 3 or they let you mill 3 cards and then they take damage equal to the total converted mana cost of the cards you milled, which I expect people would just be afraid of that. Obviously, it's random, but I have all these 7-mana functional 7-mana sorceries in the deck, so I think my average mill 3 could hit 10 damage, maybe even 20 damage. If I hit two of those in an Ulamog, that's 20 damage right there. So I was thinking this could function as just like a 6-mana draw 3 that would be pretty good to unexpected results into, or also decent to just sort of ramp into it naturally. So that's what I took through the second league, which went a little bit better. And actually, Damon, you got to try this deck out to help you finish it out too. What were your impressions?
Well, first I just want to say that I think the Combustible Gear Hulk interaction with these mythic dual face cards is the most fair, unfair use of them I've seen yet. So I thought that was really cool, Dan. I got a chance to play this list in Processi one match, and I was up against Black-Red Village Rites Pyromancer deck, and man, it was a wild ride. Game one, I got a Combustible Gear Hulk online, and the opponent was like, I'm going to take it. I can take this, no problem. I'm like, all right, and I flip it over, and it's 12. And the next turn, I like play another Gear Hulk, and they're like, all right, take it again, and it was 9. So I just tied to 2 Gear Hulk triggers. I don't know why they took the second one to the face. Honestly, I was going to tag them for 6. So that was maybe just irresponsible where they decided to see what would happen. But yeah, the next game, I believe I turned Timber Symbiosis into an Ulamog, just hard casting it off 7 mana. And Ulamog is a good Magic card.
Yeah, so you got it off the Symbiosis. You didn't get the cast trigger, but you just had a 10-10 Indestructible.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it kills in 2 turns off the Exile Clause, even if they have any number of Trump blockers.
True.
And especially against Red-Black, because they are flying through their deck, so they don't have a chance. Sometimes, you know, you can survive the second attack and, you know, get in your third attack if you're the opponent. But I think Red-Black is just, like Damon says, the 40 cards is... way more than they have left in their library.
Yeah, they're casting Stitcher Supplier and supplying their own doom.
Exactly.
So I went 1-4 in the first league, 3-2 in the second league with the assist from Damon there in the last round. I found a couple things. The updated list was much better on the mana. I was actually casting Omnath reliably. It was such a relief. The weaknesses, I found that apart from Teferi, just embarrassing, unexpected results. Combo lists were a little bit troublesome because what we have at the end of the day is a fancy ramp deck. And so I did get paired against like a Lotus Fields combo. I got paired against Oops All Spells combo, where the Pioneer version of that doesn't have the fancy Venge Vine or Charbuttle stuff, but it does let you mill your deck. It does let you trigger Creeping Chill 4 times and get Nork Amoebas, which then get Silver Smoke Ghouls and Prize Amalgams, and they shuffle back World's Bindworms. So it is sort of almost a kill when that happens, and that happens on turn 4 because both Undercity Informer and Ballast Raised by are legal in Pioneer. So both of those matchups, I had some counterspells in the sideboard, but not much else that could interact, and I'm not totally sure if this strategy can solve that just because of the way it's built and the inherent randomness of, you know, it's a weird deck, a ramp plus unexpected results plus giant hits. And I'm still kind of on the fence about whether Combustible Gear Hulk is even worth it. I think there were some matchups where I found that even just drawing 3 cards wasn't going to win. I needed like the Ugin. You know, obviously the league that I cut the Ugins, that's the league I got paired against all the aggro decks. You know, I got paired against Gruul aggro and like a weird Assault Formation wall deck. I even got paired against this really cool Bant Blink Collected Company Yorion deck from Austin Abels, who's the player who I think first... brought the mono green planeswalker deck to sort of our collective attention via Aspiring Spike. So he was chatting to me about this list. He said he 5-0'd a couple times with it. And when I was paired against him, he was also playing with Yorion in the list. It was pretty impressive. This is just a very fair Skyclave Apparition deck. So fair that it was even playing like Khazandu Mammoth and other flip cards like that, that are creatures, just so you could have more company hits. You could collect a company and hit, you know, your flip land and play it as a creature.
What are the other blink cards in there, Dan, besides Yorion?
So the main one was Charming Prince, and the second one will be Teferi Time Raveler. So that's not blink, but I guess it bounces right. Your own thing.
I take your point.
Yes, you can. There's spell quellers in here, so you can do the line where you spell queller their thing, play Teferi, bounce your queller. They can't recast their spell.
Yeah. Was he playing the 3-mana clone that's also a land? Glasspool Mimic?
I did not see that one. I saw the Mammoth, and I saw the 1/3 that gains life.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah, I played one Mimic in my Modern list. I forgot to mention that. That's a super cool card that I think should be basically in every shell going forward. It's a cool way to copy more expensive spells in play if you want to like cord for an effect that you already have, but you don't have enough mana to like cord for another Resto Angel or whatever. Yeah. So like you say, if you're trying to increase your density of collected company hits, but you still want to make sure you hit all your land drops, both the Mammoth and this card are very reasonable power, three mana creatures that are both lands and then can later become something more.
Yeah, and I guess I thought of it as a Blink deck because the way I experienced the game was that Austin would eventually set up these Charming Prince Uriah loops. The way the timing works, those will just keep looping each other. But it's actually a fairly compact Blink package. So without Ugin in my deck, I was just like helpless. You know, I had an Oodle Ball and just couldn't do anything because I was about to die to a horde of Gray Ogres. So I'm not sure in the end, like, if this is a deck or not. I think I'd probably be more inclined to just try out Will Urker's Hour of Promise deck, because I think that one will more reliably get Ulamog cast triggers, which was the best thing this deck can do. For the sake of Omnath Week, I think you kind of have to move to a different mana base. The Trion mana base did work, so that was encouraging. It's just a fun deck to play around with. So what are our final thoughts on the card, Omnath, Locus of Creation?
I mean, Omnath is the push mythic in the most recent set, and standard sets have gotten significantly more powerful in the last 2 years. So this card is among the more powerful cards that are available to us in Modern, Pioneer, and Standard. I think we even said, I mean, literally the day it was spoiled, if you can play this card and play a fetch land right after it, you got a free 4/4 that gained 4 life and replaced itself. And it needs to be killed because it's a threat to do stuff for the rest of the game. So, you know, I think it's a little bit sort of like when we had Oko week and we were winning with ninjas and we were winning with this and that. And it's just like, yeah, Oko is just a great card. Omnath maybe isn't quite as fun because we didn't have anyone on this podcast saying he was bad. And we just all thought he was good to quite good. And it turns out he's, you know, great to quite great or, you know, whatever. Maybe I thought he was an 8 and he's a 9, you know, kind of a deal. So there was nobody that we had to kind of jab at. So yeah, I guess my impression was it's just a generically powerful card. You don't need to take advantage of that many synergies. Obviously, to get the most out of them, you do want to hit 2 land drops, but in formats with fetch lands, it's trivial.
Yeah, I mean, the age-old debate of Baneslayer Angel versus Muldrifter, Omnath shows up and the answer is, ¿por qué no los dos? let's just get it all. And it has led to the contribution of people actually playing basic planes in Standard. Which I have to say is really saying this card is pushed at the point that it goes that far. And it's true. The card, I mean, if it wasn't for the cantrip clause, like I could see the card sometimes being kind of, you know, whiffing a bit or being a little bit kind of airy. You know, you gain 4 life, but it doesn't really do much else besides be a 4/4. But the card freaking cantrips. Like, it's good. It's a little, it's too good.
It's kind of wild. I think if this card didn't cantrip, it wouldn't be that good. And because it does cantrip, it's like possibly broken.
Yeah.
But you can't draw like half a card, right? So maybe if it like scryed 2 or something. I mean,
yeah,
I don't
draw
know.
1, discard 1. We'd be discarding Arclight Phoenixes somehow. But yeah. It'd be better than Ancestral Recall, actually, right, Dan?
Exactly. Well, you said it, Damon. I think the integers were the problem with Magic. You know, we need more knobs to tune. Half a card.
Yeah, it's true.
But I think Damon points out they should just be having these cards loot instead of draw if you're not 100% sure. But they want to sell packs, so they should have had a draw too, honestly, if they really want to sell it.
Yeah, and the numbers, I mean, 4 life and 4 mana are just like, those are big numbers here. Like, if we're 2 life and 2 mana, you know, it'd still be a pretty good card.
So it should be like a draw 4 wild, like an Uno, just for symmetry.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the Omnath that we're living with. Until Omnath dips his hands into a different flavor of Doritos and comes out with all 5 colors of mana.
Yeah, the 5 color Omnath is just like tear up your opponent's deck and throw it in the garbage. End the turn.
And then the next Omnath will be, this Omnath cannot be torn up.
Yeah.
So you play your 5 color Omnath and make them tear up their deck, but they have the Omnath and it can't be torn up and they win the game.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah,
somehow.
It's a counterattack.
Well, I think that's as good a place as any to leave our discussion of Omnath for this week. Certainly have not seen the last of this card. I think it's all over the place in all formats. It's a really fun card to have in play, so I do encourage you to just get your hands out and try it out for yourself. You know, as much as you hear people complaining about it, it's a blast to sort of, it's a thrill to see how much you get for having this in play. Enjoy it while you can.
Yeah, this is the honeymoon phase.
I will say the early returns in Pioneer and Modern is that it's just another powerful card in formats filled with powerful cards. It is not dominating top 8 lists. The Uro lists are not more or less prevalent. It does ask a little bit extra of your mana, especially because these Uro lists always wanted to win with Field of the Dead. It's not trivial. Like Damon says, now they're considering having to play basic mountain, basic plains. These are not cards that let you cast Uro anymore since we've eliminated our snow overlords. So Yeah, I think it's just we're ignoring standard. I think it's actually quite a fun addition to both formats.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will have our brew session for this week featuring Cleansing Wildfire. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Our card for this week is Cleansing Wildfire, a new common out of Zendikar Rising, and at one in a red for a sorcery. Destroy target land. Its controller may sorcery library for a basic land card, put on the battlefield tap, then shuffle their library, and draw a card. So just some quick comments. This is any sort of land. Hey, you can hit basics. You can cast it once they get a basic. You can cast another one on that basic if you want. Unlike Field of Ruin, the search is optional. And also the card enters tapped. And so unlike Field of Ruin, if I field them now, they could play a opt end of turn or a path to exile or something. But with Cleansing Wildfire, that's just not an issue. It comes to play tapped. And then notably, it doesn't say if land was destroyed or anything. Like the draw card and the search all happen no matter what when the card resolves. And so, for example, if you have an indestructible land, which maybe we'll talk about, then you kind of just get to reap all the rewards without having to actually destroy a land. On the other hand, it has to resolve for you to get this cleansing goodness. So targeting a fetch land is a recipe for disaster. So, Dan, what does this card make you think?
Yeah, this card raises some questions for me. I think we all like it in the abstract, but when get down to the nitty-gritty, it's like, how much is this effect actually worth? So if I'm just thinking about the straightforward use of the card, targeting an opponent's land, you target a dual land, you're sort of downgrading it, they get a basic. Is that actually a good use of a turn? Two mana is not much, but it's not nothing. Obviously, being a cantrip helps. So is this like a thing you're just like happy to do? I'm guessing probably not, but what if you think of it as an investment towards your future? Like maybe you're envisioning that later in the game, you'll have run them out of basics, whether by doing wildfires multiple times or in conjunction with Path to Exile or something. So that's one question. It's just like, how happy are we with the face value of this card functioning as Rosewater or Garfield intended? Secondly, how hard do we have to push on the synergies? So I mentioned other cards like Field of Ruin, like Ghost Quarter, like Assassin's Trophy, can tax the opponent's basics. I think modern players have gotten kind of comfortable with the idea of, okay, I should probably have some minimum number of basic lands in my deck to, have something to find off path or to maybe fetch to get around a Blood Moon or something. But should we be trying to lean on that as a weakness in how modern decks are built and just try to really assume that people run out of basic lands? Alternatively, I'm wondering if this is something that you can play, think of as a land destruction card that would play alongside more familiar land destruction options. In the past, that has meant Blood Moon, Stone Rain, Pillage. There are also packages like, Leon and Arbiter would be one. You can think of Spreading Seas as another land hate card. So does this actually fit alongside any of those, or is this kind of doing its own thing? Or are we supposed to be pointing this at our own lands? Like Damon said, you can point at an indestructible land, point at a Flagstone Central Care, for example, and use it as like a ramp spell that draws a card. So lots of sort of basic questions about how to use it. And finally, there's also just a sort of fundamental question of like, maybe this is just supposed to be a sideboard card against Tron. And if so, is this just a... how does it stack up against other pieces you might want against Tron? So that's just a bunch of stuff that sort of runs through my head as I'm thinking about this card. I'm wondering if anything that I've said jumps out at you guys as particularly sort of worth seizing on at the outset.
In terms of how it compares to like playing alongside other land destruction spells, I don't think it really works that well. For example, with Blood Moon, typically with Blood Moon, you want to destroy their basic lands, so they're left only with mountains. But this card actually lets them find a basic land, so it kind of works the exact opposite direction you'd want to be going with that. And likewise, Stone Runner Pillage, this card is only really kind of lending itself to your cause if they run out of basics. And in the decks that are running sort of out of basics typically are already weak against Stone Runner Pillage, like Tron or whatever. It does, of course, go a turn faster against Tron than a Stone Runner Pillage deck on the draw. On the other hand, those decks typically are paired with green, so they have Arbor Elves or whatever to get out the Stone Runner on turn two on the draw.
Yeah, I could see that. So maybe the best way to sort of dig into these questions is to see how this card would function in different lists. David, you've got a bunch of different lists that you've been working on. Do you want to take us sort of through how you've been approaching this card and where you want to put it?
Yeah, so first of all, I kind of want to give a quick shout out to Aspiring Spike. He's been playing sort of like a standard Jeskai control shell, with your like Planeswalkers on 3, Planeswalkers on 4, Cryptic Command. He, of course, loves the Sharknado. And he's just playing 4 Cleansing Wildfire and 4 Trocare main. So, he's had some success with that. Whether that matches up well with the Euro piles is a point of discussion. He thinks it does. I've seen him lose a lot. And when you see a player of that high quality struggle sometimes in those matchups, I think it's a sign that maybe you're doing kind of the same thing they're doing, but a little worse. But anyway, people should check out his list. If you check out his Twitter feed, he's posted a bunch of them, and he's had some very successful days, and I think he's even 5-0'd a couple, so you'll find in the deck dump. So to kind of go all in on the artifact destruction, the first list I want to propose is what I'm calling like a boom bust slash cleanse. So you have options on turn two to cast boom bust, and the boom half targets an opponent's land and your land. And so that takes advantage of the fact that we're playing four Flag Stones of Trocare, four Cascading Cataracts. So you're basically just getting to play a straight up two mana Stone Rain. In addition, you don't draw your Boom Bust all the time. You have an opportunity to play Cleansing Wildfire on turn two. This is, like Dan said, it's just a Rampant Growth plus draw a card. So that's above the normal power level. The deck is built around some of the other kind of like white reddish shells. You have Mana Tithe as a way to punish people early in the game or even later in the game if they're low on mana. You have your four Molten Ruin, four Pillage. You have Chandra, Acolyte of Flame. She actually buys back Cleansing Wildfire or Molten Ruin or Pillage. And then you have four mana Planeswalkers because you do have the opportunity to ramp from two to four. Nahiri is a card I really like because four Nahiri, one Emrakul is just a really tight package that both lets you target random permanents. It wins the game eventually. And later in the game, when like Mana Tithe is unlikely to get a card or, you know, Boom Bust isn't useful, that's a card you just discard to her. So she's functioning like plus twoing to sort of like find the cards that matter. I like Chandra as well. It's just a really fast clock when she starts plussing. She also plus twos to generate two mana. So that triggers Boom Bust and Cleansing Wildfire. So you can do that in the same turn if necessary. And then I have Aven Mind Sensor in here. That's a card that combos with Cleansing Wildfire. So in the mid game, all of a sudden, you're turning off their fetches and you're turning Cleansing Wildfire possibly into a two mana Stone Rain draw card.
So here, I would assume that if you look at your opening hand and it has a Cleansing Wildfire, you're hoping to cast this on your own land for the most part, right? So you're looking for one of your eight lands that work with this, the Flagstones and the Cataracts.
Yes.
Unless you happen to have a Mind Sensor.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Boom Bust, on the other hand, that's not really a ramp spell for you, right? That's just a cheap Stone Rain on them. So it's kind of like you're like a hybrid ramp and mana denial strategy.
Well, we're not a ramp strategy. We're only playing seven cards that cost four mana. So almost everything else in our deck is three or less. So we don't need ever to ramp if we don't draw Cleansing Wildfire and another land that lets us ramp. It's not the end of the world because we can still go like Mana Tithe their turn one play, Boom Bust their turn two play, or their land, and then like Molten Rain Pillage, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, okay. So you're saying you want the lands anyway. You want the Trocare and Cataracts for Boom Bust. So you're just playing Wildfire because you can, not because you have to.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think that just sort of is the line of question I would ask is that, what is the Cleansing Wildfire doing here for this deck that makes it worth the slot?
Well, one, sometimes we don't get to play eight Boom Bust effects. So this is another card that is above rate to cast on turn two when you have one of your eight lands it works with. It doesn't blow up a land, but it does kind of stay with you on plan. It lets you accelerate. It lets you draw a card. And then when you get in the mid game, Nahiri is a card that's both turning your useless if they've already gotten all their lands into play, land destruction to something else, while basically proceeding towards it being a one card sort of win condition.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. The other direction I might want to take this deck, and this would necessitate some change, is what if you, instead of playing so many Molten Rains and Pillages, you played like Path to Exiles and Field of Ruins and just tried to like run them out of basic lands?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. The problem is if you're going to play four Cascading Cataracts, four Flagstone of Trocare, and some amount of Field of Ruins, you're starting to run low for red as your second mana source. You know, we're just listing 12 cards that make colorless or white.
Hmm. You could play Chromatic Star, maybe. That works with Boom Bust. No, that's not true. It works with Crack the Earth, but...
Yes. You could play Crack the Earth as well. That's another card that... It works okay with a few cards here. It works okay with Flagstones of Trocare. It's a fine card with Chandra, Acolyte of Flame, because she creates a bunch of 1/1s. But that card also leads you to play a bunch of other like really mediocre cards, you know, artifacts that cycle and things like this. So I'm a little skeptical of that card.
It was better with Arkham's Astrolabe.
Well, it was better if you had Arkham's Astrolabe, but sure. If your opponent played it, you're like, man, I'm definitely not killing a land with this ever.
Yeah. This is one of those lists where it's so hard to get the right ratios of the different effects. Like, yeah, see, you have one ghostly prison here. I was watching Canister stream at Challenger, I think not last weekend, but 2 weekends ago. And you ran into a similar kind of red-white deck featuring a lot more of the prison angle with, like, suppression fields and ghostly prisons. And so trying to, like, kind of dial in these knobs of, like, the planeswalkers versus the land destruction versus the interaction, like, the bolts and the mana tithes. I really wonder, like, how do we figure out the right list? Like, is it possible we try this and we're like, oh, it's terrible, but if we just tweak the list and the card choices a little bit, it actually would be a very cohesive prison package. Because prison packages are so low resource that a single wrong card can just lose you a game.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also going to feel really bad. Like, this is a deck that doesn't have a lot of comeback mechanism. So if you get behind, it's going to feel worse than it is if you take my meaning. You're going to be losing the game badly for five turns as well. Whereas when you win, it might feel like you're just a little bit ahead of them until they're basically dead.
So chasing that feeling a little bit more, we have some more red-white decks. Do you want to take us through this Hate Bears?
Yeah, so these two decks are similar. They're basically red-white lists. You know, when this card was spoiled, Damon was saying, oh, I'm going to hate this card with Leonin Arbiter. So I figured I'd have to like throw a list together for him that has four of each. They differ in that one has a Stoneforge Mystic package, and then the other is trying to play Lurrus. So we don't get to play the Stoneforge Mystic package, and we also don't get to play Flicker Wisp or Skyclave Apparition. So the basic package is basically Ether Vial, Giver of Ruins, Lightning Bolt, Leonin Arbiter, Thalia, Garden of Thraben, and Cleansing Wildfire. And so you can, you know, the dream start is you play your Leonin Arbiter on two and Cleansing Wildfire the next turn, and it's just a straight up two mana Stone Rain. Plus, if you play a Ghost Quarter, you could blow up two of their lands. So, I mean, that's your like dream out. And being able to play a Giver of Ruins on one means that you can often protect your Leonin Arbiter from the first removal spell, or she's going to sort of jump in front of the train. And then like what you want to sort of surround that with, you know, so the package that doesn't rely on Lurrus lets you play Flicker Wisp, Skyclave Apparition, and Mind Sensor, along with, you know, Batterskull and sort of Fire and Ice. And then the Lurrus Hate Bears list, you know, is playing Mishra's Bauble, Seal of Fire. I'm playing Smuggler's Copter, Sarah Avenger, and Tomic Distinguished Advocate. Sort of just to like fill out your deck with the additional two mana threats that still allow us to play Lurrus and have some synergy with the rest of what we're trying to do.
This may be me overreacting to early results, but I'm like, the list that has the Skyclave Apparitions must be the better list, right? The more well-rounded list.
I mean, that's my sense. That's the list I came up with first, but I think it's always worth considering when the base of your list is so close to something that can play Lurrus, and Lurrus is very good, as all companions are, with Ether Vial. You almost get the old effect where you only pay three mana to get this card. If you have a Vial on three, you know, you don't have to pay anything extra. So that is very sweet. The problem with Lurrus is it interacts relatively poorly with Thalia, because the thing you want to do is buy back your Bauble and Seal of Fire every turn, and Thalia taxes you for that if she's still in play. Although he also lets you replay Thalia if that's an important card, etc. So
yeah, you could always just run Lurrus main deck, although it's a little tricky where these decks are built to kind of just go back and forth. One thing I wonder, in the list with the Flicker Wisps, are there any good MDFCs? Because you can play it as a land and then Flicker Wisp it and it comes back as a creature, which is an interesting interaction I've seen a couple times.
Yeah, so the white one is a gain two effect. I don't think that's quite worth it. The red one, there's a red uncommon that I think is a 4/5 trample. And so that card is like reasonably playable if you think of it as sort of like a...
Didn't Dan call it a Trinium Nemesis in Modern?
You can think of it as like some of those delve threats. You know, the problem is the coming to play land is quite poor in a shell like this, where it doesn't cast Ether Vial on turn one, and we don't have a lot of red cards we're interested in casting. But yeah, I think that's actually a really cool angle, and it might be worth adding as a one of. Because I think these decks kind of want to play 22 and a half lands. So I always had the 23rd in, because we do have like Ghost Quarter and Field of Ruin, like things we can do with our lands. So you could like feasibly cut a Field of Ruin and add that as a 23rd land.
I have no idea what that card is called. That's the big Minotaur, right? For six.
Yeah.
Akum Warrior.
Akum Warrior. One of the few cards that if they Skyclave Apparition it, you actually upgrade your creature to a 6/6 by killing the apparition.
Actually, apparition is three or less, or four or less. So Akum Warrior is in fact true name of Modern, Dan.
Oh my gosh. Yep. Oh my gosh. This is getting better and better. All right, well, I think between the two of them, I'm kind of inclined to try out the one with the Stoneforge package and the Skyclaves. Just I think that has more angles covered, but, you know, Lurrus has proven and ethervials are a nice companion for lures. So yeah, maybe give both of them a try.
Yeah. One card I kind of want to try on one of these lists is Valakut Exploration. I've heard this card is pretty good. It's the card that's 2 in red for enchantment and landfall. You exile the top card of your library and you can play that card. And what I like about that in these sorts of lists is, first off, these red-white lists just run out of gas really hard, really fast some games. There's just not a whole lot of fundamental kind of card draw in them. And you can always use Cleansing Wildfire to get a landfall trigger.
Well, that's interesting.
Like, probably it's like a one of. It's like a, you know, a one of Sylvan Library in Legacy Maverick. You don't really want to draw multiple. I mean, actually, Valakut Exploration is not terrible in multiple. Sylvan Library is really bad in multiple.
That's interesting. So for the purposes of making landfall, you can treat the Cleansing Wildfire as a land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I like where we're going with this. So those are some modern ideas. You've also got some pioneer concepts. You want to run those by us?
Yeah, so these lists are both very similar. One adds blue to a mono red shell, but basically what they're trying to do is you have seven lands. You have two different kinds of lands that are indestructible, Darksteel Citadel and Cascading Cataracts that are pioneer legal. I have seven of each in each of these lists, and the fourth Darksteel Citadel is in the sideboard because it is a target for Karn the Great Creator. Warping Whale is like a homeless man's way to accelerate. You can cast it on their EOT, and then you can sack it on your turn. So you have basically like seven ways to get to eight mana, and you're trying to sort of play this Karn the Great Creator, Thought Not Seer, Forsaken Monument kind of package. And I guess I'm more enamored with the blue list because Eldrazi Skyspawner and Herald of Kozilek are both kind of cool cards. They accelerate into your Forsaken Monument. They also like get paid off by the monument itself. Like monument adding two power to two different cards with Eldrazi Skyspawner is like super cool. And then both of these lists are playing for Spikefield Hazard. I think this card is super good. It might be one of the better two-sided lands. We talked about some of its applications last week and just playing around with it a little bit and seeing it in action. It's actually great against a bunch of cards. Mono Black is the most popular deck in Pioneer. And they are now playing more one toughness creatures than ever because they replaced some number of their Scrap Heap Scroungers with the 3/1 card that when landfall triggers, you can cast it from your graveyard. So, I mean, they have like 11 or 13 cards that come back from the graveyard that have one toughness. So already it's good there. It's reasonable against Uro's front half. Obviously, it's not the best way. And then it does kill mana elves. So I think this card is just great. It's an extra red source to make sure, you know, if we see that we're on the play, we play it tapped. So that we always have an untapped red on turn two to target our Darksteel Citadel or Cascading Cataracts. And I just think that the like Karn the Great Creator, Myriad Construct, Forsaken Monument, like shell is really interesting. It synergizes very well with each other. It presents like an interesting endgame. The fact that we kind of get to play the same lands, even with blue, the splash for Eldrazi Skyspawner and Herald of Kozilek is almost free. So yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by this deck.
So these, I would characterize the Cleansing Wildfire as almost like a Mind Stone type effect, right? So you're thinking, okay, well, the Wildfire works with these indestructible lands. Those are colorless lands, so I'll play the Eldrazi that require colorless mana. As straight-up cards you're just going to cast, those are more Pioneer speed than Modern speed. I think that's more or less true. So yeah, I mean, finding a home for Karn the Great Creator in a shell like this in Pioneer, I think is very, very attractive. I think where it really kicks into overdrive, though, is with these lines you're identifying with the Forsaken Monument, a card that I didn't really think that much of it. It kind of reads like a greedy EDH card, but having now played against this card a couple times, it is terrifying once it's in play. They get life, so you're not going to kill them. They get major boost to their creatures, +2/+2 to each creature, and they get double mana in a Karn deck. So this is like, I think, your way to keep pace, even if you find yourself paired against a deck that is looking to ramp harder than you are.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to trying out Forsaken Monument in Pioneer. I know, David, you've been a big fan of this card.
You know, I had the exact same impression as Dan. I think we both looked at it. You were probably mountain manning it up in the above 10,000 feet somewhere, Damon, that week. But it was in the dump. We didn't even talk about it. We were just like, you know, it's a maybe a one of in a sideboard in modern Eldrazi Tron. And then the more I thought, I was like, this is, it has a lot of the hallmarks of what we consider to be like quote unquote mistakes. It gives you life, so the game doesn't end. So it's like a bad Omnath in that, or Uro in that way. It gains you a bunch of life, just incidentally. That line of text wouldn't need to be there for the card to be interesting. It's a huge mana resource for no reason, and it adds a ton of power to the board. So yeah, I think the card seems innocuous at first. It seemed innocuous to me. And then the more I like thought about it, and the more I like tooled around with it. It was just like, wow, this is a card that's sometimes adding like 6 to 10 power. This is a card that's sometimes gaining 4 to 6 life a turn. Because you have Karn, you almost have this like unlimited way to use the mana. Like it's just a giant mana sink. And Karn also finds the card. The interaction with Myriad Construct we talked about last week. So, but I mean, even just like turning your Herald of Kozilek accelerates into it. And then all of a sudden it's this 4-6 blocker against aggro that makes all your spells even cheaper. And your lands are tapping for more. It's just you can just imagine some of the lines. These aren't magical Christmas lines where all of a sudden you're just getting an insane amount of value.
Yeah, it feels like it's almost as good as Omnath. It doesn't draw you a card, of course.
Well, that's the problem. If this cycle, when it came into play, we'd have problems.
Yeah. I'm slightly joking. This card clearly does things that Omnath doesn't do in terms of like pumping your team and things like that.
So as far as Karn the Great Creator decks go in Pioneer, I think that, David, what you've got here is solving some of the problems that those archetypes have faced. The first problem is speeds. I mean, so far, Karn has only really made it in Llanowar Elvish Mystic decks. Cleansing Wildfire gives you some of that speed back. The second is just like, you know, you need a lot of mana in play to make that work. And it's hard to get your mana count right without just flooding out. So the Spike Field Hazard as a sort of half land, half early interaction also addresses that really nicely. And then I think the third piece is like finding the powerful payoff that actually keeps pace with the most powerful things in the formats. And I think that the Forsaken Monument is a way to do that that is very cool. I was wondering if you had considered a different route using Fall of the Thran. And I'm thinking here of a deck that we featured on the Brew Review a couple of weeks ago. One of our listeners submitted this deck that was trying to cast this Armageddon Saga and then eat the opponent's graveyard.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the shell and I remember our discussions with Omnath even on it. The thing I've always had problems with the Fall of the Thran is you want to build your deck to take advantage of the Fall of the Thran, but then Armageddon effects are only powerful if you're ahead or even at parity. You're spending your whole turn 5 mana just to destroy all lands, and on their turn they spent 5 mana to do something, probably add to the board in some way, right? Cast their Planeswalker, cast their Forsaken Monument or Karn or Glory B. And so I found that to be an insoluble problem for me as I start to think about, I want to maximize all these ways once I resolve my 5-mana Armageddon, but I also need to have a way where I'm like ahead on board and all these machinations where I'm not letting them get their lands back doesn't just lose me the game because I'm spending all my time setting up this play that doesn't actually affect, it affects the board, it does destroy their lands, but it doesn't affect the cards that are attacking or blocking. And Planeswalkers are the way that Pioneer is often playing to the board, or you think about a deck like Mono Black. It's just really hard to interact with that and still, you know, keep these synergies where you're benefiting from the Armageddon, where you're breaking the symmetry of that Armageddon.
Yeah, I could see that. So of all these lists that we have presented here, David, you got 5 lists plus Aspiring Spike sort of Jeskai control-ish good stuff list. What do you guys think of the prospects for Cleansing Wildfire? What are we going to find when we take this into the queues? Are we thinking we're going to be casting it to primarily ramp ourselves, I think? Maybe deny the mana if we're in the Taxus strategy?
I think that to some extent, Modern may have already warped around Cleansing Wildfire in the sense that there's just a lot less decks that are vulnerable to it in the form of like Tron. And so the card will certainly have applications on hitting the opponent's lands, but I suspect that it'll be less than it was pre-Zendikar Rising.
Yeah, I think of it as a card that you need to sort of have a plan to use on yourself. And then you have this side benefit where if you play in Modern specifically against some of these big mana decks, you just kind of have this like oops, I win effect. But not oops, I win, but oops, I'm heavily favored game one against Tron, where normally Jeskai, for instance, would not be. But like Damon says, maybe the metagame is already adjusted where you're just not going to play Tron a lot. Now, I've played big mana twice already today in Modern, so maybe that's, you know, there's still people playing decks that aren't good in all stages of the queue. So, you know, if you're not in like the super competitive the challenges and things like that, it might just steal games.
Not so much oops, I win. It's oops, I'm heavily favored in game one against Tron. Okay. All right. I can live with that.
That was that Britney Spears song from the 90s, right?
Yeah. But I mean, you know, so much of Modern is bringing in your sideboard cards that win certain matchups or change the percentages. But if you change your game one percentage against a reasonable percentage of the metagame, that is just a big side effect. And the fact that I'm playing against black red or whatever. It also behooves you, I think, to start looking at some of these lists. A lot of people are just copying, you know, lists that did well at the challenge. You can look and determine how many basic lands they have. And so sometimes they draw their one or two and you're destroying their only white source in mono red or, you know, in red, white burn, for instance. That you're destroying the lands that draw a card against humans. Then it's a straight up 2-for-1 in that instance.
Yeah, and all these all spell lists don't play any basic lands.
Yeah,
and the card is straight up broken when it is a Stone Rain effect.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm curious to lean more on that angle myself. All right. Well, I think that we have our work cut out for us for this week. A lot of decks to test. Damon, you want to take us home?
Yeah. So hopefully this Cleansing Wildfire week will be a little cleansing palette for all of us. And so we will see how things go and look forward to seeing anybody who's out there in the queues with us or in the Community League with Canadian Highlander.
All right. Take care.
See ya. That brings us to the end of episode 74 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Decklists from this episode can be found on our brand new website, faithlessbrewing.com. This is our brand new content hub, the home of our podcast, as well as articles, strategy, and more to come. There is a link in the episode description that will take you right to it. We hope to see you there. If you'd like to support what we do, if you enjoy listening to our podcast every week and feel like throwing us some of your hard-earned dollars, we would really appreciate that. We are a listener-supported cast, and your contributions are what make this show possible. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is where you can sign up if you'd like to become a supporting member. You will get various benefits for doing so, starting with access to our Discord, access to extended show notes with bonus content, all the way up to merchandise and Faithless Brewing playmats at the highest tiers. We would also love it if you took a minute to leave us a friendly review on Apple Podcasts or whichever app you use to listen to pods. That gives us a little algorithm boost, helps new listeners discover our podcast, and also just makes us feel good about ourselves. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to know how we're doing. That's all for this week. We hope you're staying safe, and we will see you next time.